corpse. I thought of Murphy's office and what it would look like with her sprawled on the floor, her heart torn from her chest, or her throat torn out by some creeping thing from beyond. "Sorry, Murph," I said. My voice came out in a rasping whisper. "I wish I could help you. I don't know anything useful." I didn't try to look up at her, and I tried to hide that I was lying. I sensed, more than saw, the hardening around her eyes, the little lines of hurt and anger. I'm not sure if it was a tear that fell, or if she really just raised a hand to brush back some of her hair. Then she turned toward the front door and shouted, "Carmichael, get your ass in here." Carmichael looked equally as slobbish as he had a few days ago, as though the passage of time hadn't changed him. It certainly hadn't changed his jacket, or the food stains on his tie, or the particular pattern of rumple to his hair. There had to be something comforting, I reflected, in that kind of stability. No matter how bad things got, no matter how horrible or sickening the scene, you could always count on Carmichael to look like the same quality of crap. He glared at me as he came in. "Yeah." She tossed the plastic bag to him, and he caught it. "Mark that and log it," she said. "Hang around for a minute. I want a witness." Carmichael looked down at the bag and saw my card. His beady eyes widened. He looked back up at me, and I saw the shift in gears in his head, reclassifying me from annoying ally to suspect. "Mr. Dresden," Murphy said. She kept her tone frosty, polite. "There are some questions we'd like to ask you. Do you think you could come down to the station and make a statement?" Questions to be asked. The White Council would convene and execute me in little more than 30 hours. I didn't have time for questions. "I'm sorry, Lieutenant. I've got to comb my hair tonight." "Tomorrow morning, then?" she said. "We'll see," I said. "If you aren't there in the morning," Murphy said, "I'm going to ask for a warrant. We'll come and find you, and by God, Harry, I'll get some answers to this." "Suit yourself," I told her, and I started for the door. Carmichael took a step forward and stood in my way. I stopped and looked at him, and he kept his eyes focused on the center of my chest. "If I'm not under arrest," I told her, "then I presume I'm free to go." "Let him go, Ron," Murphy said. Her tone of voice was disgusted, but I could hear the hurt underneath it. "I'll talk to you again soon, Mr. Dresden." She stepped closer and said, in a perfectly even tone, "And if it turns out that you're the one behind all of this, rest assured, whatever you do, and whatever you can pull, I will find you, and I will bring you down. Do you understand me?" I did understand, really. I understood the pressure she was under, her frustration, her anger, and her determination to stop the killing from happening again. If I was some kind of hero from a romance novel, I would have said something brief and eloquent and heart-rending, but I'm just me, so I said, "I do understand, Karen." Carmichael stepped out of my way, and I walked away from Murphy, who I couldn't talk to, and from Linda, who I couldn't protect. My head aching, weary to my bones, and feeling like a total piece of shit.
Please insert the next CD to continue the story.
I walked down the block from Linda Randall's apartment building, my thoughts and emotions a far more furious thunderstorm than the one now rolling away from the city, out over the vastness of the lake. I called a cab from the payphone outside of a gas station and stood about with my back resting against a wall of a building in the misting rain, scowling and waiting. I had lost Murphy's trust. It didn't matter that I had done what I had done to protect both her and myself. Noble intentions meant nothing. It was the results that counted. And the results of my actions had been telling a bald-faced lie to one of the only people I could come close to calling a friend. And I wasn't sure that even if I found the person or persons responsible, even if I worked out how to bring them down, even if I did Murphy's job for her, that what had happened between us would ever be smoothed over. My thoughts were on that topic and similar issues of doom and gloom, when a man with a hat pulled low over his face began to walk past me, stopped halfway, turned, and drove his fist into my belly. I had time to think, "Not again," and then he struck me a second and a third time. Each blow drove into my guts, thrust me back against the unyielding wall, made me sick. My breath flew out of my mouth in a little strangling gasp, and even if I'd had a spell already in mind, I wouldn't have had the breath to speak it. I sort of sagged when he stopped hitting me, and he threw me to the ground. We were at a lit gas station just before midnight on a Friday night, and anything he did was in full view of any of the cars going by. surely God he didn't plan on killing me. Though for a moment I was too tired and achy to care. I lay there for a moment, dazed. I could smell my attacker's sweat and cologne. I could tell it was the same person who had jumped me the night before. He grabbed my hair, jerked my head up, and, with an audible snip of steel scissors, cut off a big lock of my hair, then let me go. My blood went cold. My hair. The man had cut off my hair. It could be used in almost any kind of magic, any kind of deadly spell, and there wouldn't be a damn thing I could do about it. The man turned to start away, walking quickly but not running. In a flood of panic and desperation, I leapt at his leg, got him around the knee, and yanked hard. I heard a distinctive little pop, and the man screamed, "Son of a bitch!" and fell heavily to earth. One fist, one very large and knob-knuckled fist, was clutched around my hair. I tried to suck in a breath and leapt for that hand. My attacker's hat had fallen off, and I recognized him, one of Johnny Marconi's men who had followed me from the hotel on Thursday afternoon, the one who had begun limping after jogging after me for several blocks. Apparently Gimpy had a trick knee, and I had just made a jump through its hoop. I grabbed onto his wrist and held on with both hands. I'm not a particularly strong man, but I'm made out of wire and stubborn as hell. I curled up around his waist and hung on, trying to pry the thick fingers. Gimpy tried to jerk his arm away. He was carrying a lot of muscle on that arm, but it wasn't enough to move the weight of my whole body. He shoved at me with his other arm, trying to push me off of him, then started pounding on me with one fist. "Let go of me, damn it!" Gimpy shouted. "Get off me!" I hunched my head down, my shoulders up, and hung on. If I could dig my thumbs into his tendons for long enough, his hand would have to come open, no matter how strong he was. I tried to imagine his wrist as Play-Doh and my thumbs as solid steel pushing into him, and held on for everything I was worth. I felt his fingers start to loosen. I could see the dark, thin strands of my hair. "Jesus Christ!" someone shouted. "Hey, Mike, come on!" There were running footsteps. And then a couple of young guys dressed in jogging suits and sneakers came over and dragged me off Gimpy. I screamed incoherently as my hands slipped from Gimpy's wrist. Some of my hair spilled out onto the wet concrete, but more stayed in his grip as his fingers closed over it. "Easy, man, easy," one of the guys was saying as they dragged me off. "Take it easy." There wasn't any use struggling against the pair of them. Instead, I dragged in a breath and managed to gasp, "Wallet! He's got my wallet!" Considering the way I was dressed, compared to Gimpy's suit and coat, that was one lie that was never going to get off the ground. Or at least it wouldn't have, if Gimpy hadn't turned and started hurrying away. The two men let me go, confused. Then, taking the cautious route, they started away, walking hurriedly towards their car. I struggled to my feet and after Gimpy, wheezing like a leaky accordion. Gimpy headed across the street to a car and was already in it and leaving by the time I got there. I shambled to a halt in a cloud of his exhaust and stared dully after his taillights as he drove off into the misting rain. My heart pounded in my chest and didn't slow down even after I recovered my breath. My hair. Johnny Marconi now has a lock of my hair. He could give it to someone who used magic and use it to do whatever they damn well pleased to me. They could use my hair to tear out my heart from my chest, rip it right out like they had done to Jennifer Stanton and Tommy Tom and poor Linda Randall. Marconi had warned me to stop twice, and now he was going to take me out once and for all. My weariness, fear, and fatigue were abruptly burned away by anger. "Like hell," I snarled. "Like hell, you will." All I had to do was find them. Find Johnny Marconi, find Gimpy, and find Marconi's wizard, whoever he or she was. Find them, get my hair back, lay them out like ninepins, and send Murphy to round them up. By God, I wasn't going to take this lying down. These assholes were serious. They'd already tried to kill me once, and they were coming after me again. Marconi and his boys. No, I thought. Not Marconi. That didn't make any sense. Unless it had been Marconi's gang dealing the three-eye from the very beginning. If Marconi had a wizard in residence, why would he have tried to bribe me anyway? Why not just swipe a lock of hair from me when he'd sent the thug with the bat, and then kill me when I didn't pay attention? Could it be Marconi? Or could this thug be playing two sides of the street? I decided that ultimately it didn't matter. One thing was clear. Someone had a lock of my hair. Some wizard somewhere meant to kill me. Whoever this wizard was, he wasn't much good. I'd seen that when I'd wiped out his shadow sending spell. He couldn't stand up to me if I could force him into a direct confrontation. He might have a lot of moxie and a lot of raw power to harness the storms as he had and to slap a demon into servitude, but he was like a big, gawky teenager, new to his strength. I had more than just strength, more than just moxie. I had training, experience, and savvy on my side. Besides, at that moment I was mad enough to chew up nails and spit out paper clips. The Shadow Man couldn't take a shot at me yet. He didn't have that kind of strength. He needed to wait for the storms that came each spring and use them to kill me. I had time. I had time to work. If I could just find out where they were, where Gimpy had taken my hair, I could go after him. The answer came to me in a flash, and it seemed simple. If hair could be used as a link to the rest of me, I should be able to reverse it, to create a link from me back to the hair. Hell, maybe I could just set it on fire, burn it all the way from my apartment. A formula for a spell like that would be screwy as hell, though. I needed Bob. Bob could help me work out a spell, figure out a formula like that in minutes instead of hours or days. I grimaced. Bob was gone, and would be for another 24 hours. There was no way I could work out that formula in less than 10 or 12 hours by myself, and I didn't think my brain was coherent enough to come up with solid calculations at that moment, anyway. I could have called Murphy. Murphy would have known where Marconi was lurking, and Gimpy would probably be nearby. She could have given me an idea, at least, of how to find Gentleman Johnny, Gimpy, and the Shadow Man. But she never would now. And even if she did, she'd demand to know the whole story, and after I told it to her, she'd put me under protective custody or something ridiculous like that. I clenched my fists hard, and my nails dug into my palms. I should trim them sometimes. I looked down at my nails, then hurriedly crossed the street, standing under the gas station's lights, and stared at my hands. There was blood under my fingernails where they'd bitten into Gimpy's wrists. I threw back my head and laughed. I had everything I needed. I moved back out of the misting rain and squatted down on the concrete sidewalk. I used a bit of chalk I keep in my duster's pocket to sketch out a circle on the concrete surrounding me. Then I scraped the blood out of from under my nails and put it on the concrete between my feet. It glistened in the fine, misty fall of rain. The next part took me a moment to figure out, but I settled for using a tracking spell I already knew rather than trying to modify it into something a little more dignified. I plucked out a couple of nose hairs and put them in the circle, too, on top of the bits of Gimpy's skin and blood. Then I touched a finger to the chalk circle and willed energy into it, closing it off. I gathered up my energy from my anger, my renewed fear, my aching head and queasy stomach, and hurled it into a spell. Segui votro testatum. There was a rush of energy that focused on my nostrils and made me sneeze several times in a row. Then it came up to me, quite strongly, the scent of Gimpy's cologne. I stood up and opened the circle again with a swipe of my foot and walked out of it. I turned in a slow circle all the way around. Gimpy's scent came to me strongly from the southwest, out towards some of the richer suburbs of Chicago. I started to laugh again. I had this son of a bitch. I could follow him back to Marconi, or whoever he was working for, but I had to do it now. I had enough blood to make it last long. "Hey, buddy!" The cabbie leaned out the window and glared at me, the engine running at an idle, the end of his cheroot glowing orange. I stared at him for a second. "What?" he scowled. "What are you, deaf? Did someone call for a cab?" I grinned at him, still angry, still a little lightheaded, still eager to go kick Gimpy and the Shadow Man's teeth in. "I did." "Why do I get all the nuts?" he said. "Get in." I did, closing the door behind me. He eyed me suspiciously in the mirror and said, "Where to?" "Two stops," I told him. I gave him my apartment's address and sat back in the seat, my head automatically drawn towards the southwest, towards where the men who wanted to kill me were. "That's one," he said. "Where's number two?" I narrowed my eyes. I needed a few things from my apartment. My talismans, my blasting rod, my staff, a fetish that should be vital. And after that, I was going to have a serious talk with one of Chicago's biggest gangsters. "I'll tell you when we get there. Let's go." We ended up at the Varsity, a club Marconi owned in a Chicago suburb. It was a busy place, catering to much of the college-age crowd to be found on this side of the city, and even at 1:30 in the morning it was still fairly crowded for someplace so isolated, alone in a strip mall, the only business open at this time of the evening, the only lit windows in sight. "Loony," the cabbie muttered as he drove away. and I had to pause for a moment and agree with him. I had directed him about in a meandering line, the spell I'd cast, letting me literally follow my nose along Gimpy's trail. The spell had begun fading almost the moment I'd cast it. I didn't have enough blood to make a more lasting enchantment, but it had held long enough for me to zero in on the varsity and to identify Gimpy's car in the parking lot. I walked past the windows, and sure enough, in a large circular booth in the back, I saw Johnny Marconi, the bull-necked Mr. Hendricks, Gimpy, and Spike sitting together and talking. I ducked out of sight in a hurry before one of them noticed me. Then I walked back into the parking lot to consider exactly what I had at my disposal. A bracelet on each wrist, a ring, my blasting rod, my staff. I thought of all the subtle and devious means by which I might tilt the situation into my favor. Clever illusions, convenient faltering of electricity or water, a sudden invasion of rats or cockroaches. I could have managed any of them. Not many people who use magic are that versatile, but very few have the kind of experience and training it takes to pull such spells together on the fly. I shook my head, irritated. I didn't have time to bother with subtlety. Power into the talismans, then power into the ring. I reached for the power in both the staff and rod, cool strength of wood and seething anger of fire, and stepped up to the front door of the varsity. Then I blew it off its hinges. I blew it out rather than in. Pieces flew towards me and bounced off the shield of air I held up in front of me, while others rained back behind me into the parking lot. It wouldn't do to injure a bunch of innocent diners on the other side. You only get one chance to make a first impression. Once the door was off, I pointed my blasting rod inside and spoke a command. The jukebox slammed back against the wall as though a cannonball had impacted it, and then melted into a puddle of liquid plastic goo. The music squealed out the speakers and stopped. I stepped into the doorway and released a pent-up wave of energy from my ring. Starting at the door and then circling through the room, the light bulbs began to explode with sharp little detonations and showers of powdered glass and glowing bits of filament. People at the bar and at all the wooden tables scattered around the room, reacting as people tend to do in this sort of situation. They started screaming and shouting, rising to their feet or ducking behind their tables in confusion. A few ducked out the fire door at the back of one side of the room. Then there was an abrupt and profound silence. Everybody stood stock still and staring at the doorway. They stared at me. At the back table, Johnny Marconi regarded the doorway with his passionless, money-colored eyes. He was not smiling. Mr. Hendricks beside him was glaring at me, his single eyebrow lowered far enough to threaten him with blinding. Spike was tight-lipped and pale. Gimpy stared at me in pure horror. None of them made any moves or sound. I guess seeing a wizard cut loose can do that to you. Little pig, let me in, I said into the silence. I planted my staff on the ground and narrowed my eyes at Marconi. I'd really like to talk to you for a minute, John. Marconi stared at me for a moment, and then his lips twitched up at the corners. You have a singular manner of persuasion, Mr. Dresden. He stood up and spoke aloud to the room, without ever taking his eyes off me. He must have been angry, but the icy exterior concealed it. Ladies and gentlemen, the varsity is closing early, it would seem. Please make an orderly exit through the door nearest you. Don't worry about your bills. Mr. Dresden, if you would step out of the doorway and allow my customers to leave. I stepped out of the doorway. The place cleared out fast. Customers and staff alike, leaving me alone in the room with Marconi, Hendricks, Spike, and Gimpy. None of them moved as they waited for the customers and witnesses to leave. Gimpy started sweating. Hendricks' expression never changed. The big man was as patient as a mountain lion, ready to leap out on an unsuspecting deer. I want my hair back, I said, as soon as the last college-age couple had hustled out the door. Beg pardon, Marconi said, his head tilted to one side, and he seemed genuinely puzzled. You heard me, I said. This piece of trash of yours, I swung my blasting rod and pointed it at Gimpy, just jumped me outside a gas station across town and cut off some of my hair. I want it back. I'm not going out like Tommy Tom did. Marconi's eyes abruptly shone with a terrible, cold, money-colored anger, and he turned his head deliberately to Gimpy. Gimpy's broad face went a bit more pasty. He blinked a trickle of sweat out of his eyes. I don't know what he's talking about, boss. Marconi's gaze never wavered. I presume, Mr. Dresden, he said, that you have some kind of proof. Look at his left wrist, I said. He's got several fingernail marks on the skin where I grabbed him. Marconi nodded, those cold tiger's eyes on Gimpy's, and said, almost gently, Well?
He's lying, boss,
Gimpy protested. He licked at his lips.
Hey, I got some fingernail marks from my girl. He knew that. You know what you said. He's for real, knows things.
The pieces of the puzzle fell in place. Whoever killed Tommy Tom knows that I'm on his trail, I said. Your rival, whoever it is selling the three-eye. Gimpy here must have gotten a sweet deal from him to turn on you. He's been providing your rival with information all along, running errands for him. Gimpy couldn't have played a game of poker to save his life. He stared at me in horror, shook his head in protest. There's an easy way to settle this, Marconi said, his voice smooth and even. Lawrence, show me your wrist.
He's lying, boss,
Gimpy Lawrence said again, but his voice was shaking.
He's just trying to mess with your head.
Lawrence, Marconi said, his tone a gentle reproof of a parent to a child. Gimpy Lawrence knew it was over. I saw the desperate decision in his face before he actually moved.
Liar!
He howled at me. He got up, lifted his hand from underneath the table. I had time to realize he had a revolver, virtually a twin to my own .38, in his fist, and started shooting. Several things happened at the same time. I lifted my hand, focusing my will on the bracelet of tiny medieval-style shields around my left wrist, and hardened the protective energies around me. Bullets hammered against it with whining noises, striking sparks in the near dark of the restaurant. Spike leapt clear of the table, staying low, a small Uzi-style automatic now in his hand. Hendrix was more ruthless and direct, reacting with the mindlessly violent instincts of a savage. With one hand, the big bodyguard hauled Marconi back, putting his own bulk between the mob boss and Gimpy Lawrence. With the other hand, he produced a compact semi-automatic. Gimpy Lawrence turned his head and saw Hendrix and his gun. He panicked, turning his own weapon toward the larger man. Hendrix shot him with a ruthless efficiency. Three sharp clips of sound, three flashes of muzzle light. The first two shots hit Gimpy in the middle of the chest, driving him back a pair of steps. The third hit him right over the right eyebrow, jerked his head back, and toppled him to the ground. Gimpy Lawrence had dark eyes, like mine. I could see them. His head was turned toward me as he lay there on the floor. I saw him blink once. Then the lights went out of them, and he was gone. I stood there for a moment, stunned. Grand entrance or not, this wasn't what I wanted to happen. I didn't want to kill anyone. Hell, I didn't want anyone to die. Not me and not them. I felt sick. It had been some sort of game. A macho contest of showmanship I had been determined to win. All of a sudden, it wasn't a game anymore, and I just wanted to walk away from it alive. We all stood there, no one moving. Then Marconi said from beneath Hendrix, I wanted him alive. He could have answered several questions first. Hendrix frowned and got up off Marconi. Sorry, boss. That's all right, Mr. Hendrix. Better to err on the side of caution, I suppose. Marconi stood up, straightened his tie, and then went and knelt by the body. He felt the man's throat, then wrist, and shook his head. Lawrence, Lawrence. I would have paid you twice what they offered you, if you'd just come to me with it. You never were very smart, were you? Then his face showed no more emotion than it had the entire evening. Marconi peeled back Gimpy Lawrence's left sleeve and studied the man's wrist. He frowned and lowered the arm again, his expression pensive. It would seem, Mr. Dresden, he said, that we have a common enemy. He turned to focus his gaze on me. Who is it? I shook my head. I don't know. If I did, I wouldn't be here. I thought maybe it was you. Marconi lifted his eyebrows. You should have known me better than that, Mr. Dresden. It was my turn to frown. You're right. I should have. The killings had been more vicious, savage than Marconi would have cared to use. Competitors might have been removed, but there would be no sense in making a production out of it. Certainly there was no reason to murder bystanders like Linda, like Jennifer Stanton. It was inefficient. Bad for business.
If he has something of yours, you are welcome to take it, Mr. Dresden, Marconi said. He looked around the room and sighed. Better hurry. I think the varsity has seen its last crowd. A shame.
It was hard, but I walked over to Gimpy Lawrence's body. I had to set aside my staff, my rod, to rifle the corpse's pockets. I felt like a ghoul, crouched over the body of a dead man, picking what was valuable to me off it, out of his pockets. I didn't find my hair anywhere. I looked up at Marconi, and he regarded me with eyes without any readable emotion. Nothing, I told him.
Interesting. He must have passed the material in question to someone else before he came here, Marconi said. Someone after he got here, maybe. Marconi shook his head.
I'm quite sure he did not do that. I would have noticed.
I believe you, I told him, and I did. But who?
Our enemy, Marconi said. Obviously.
I closed my eyes, suddenly sagging with weariness. Damn it. Marconi said nothing. He stood up and issued a few quiet orders to Hendricks and Spike. Hendricks wiped down his gun with a napkin and left it lying on the floor. Spike went over behind the bar and started to do something involving a power cord and a bottle of whiskey. I gathered up my staff and Rod, stood up, and turned to Marconi. Tell me what else you know. I need everything you have if I'm going to catch this guy. Marconi considered that and nodded. Yes, you do. Unfortunately, you chose a public forum for this discussion. You have set yourself up in the eyes of anyone who cared to watch as my enemy. As understandable as your reasons might have been, the fact that you have publicly defied me remains. I cannot let that go without response, regardless of my personal feelings, without inviting more of the same. I must maintain control. It isn't personal, Mr. Dresden. It's business. I tightened my jaw and my grip on my blasting rod and made sure my shield was still there, ready to go.
So what are you going to do about it?
Nothing, he said. I need do nothing. Either our enemy will kill you, in which case I need not risk myself or my people in removing you, or you will find him in time and bring him down. If you do defeat him, I will let it be understood to any who asks that you did so at my behest, after which I will be inclined to forget this evening. Either way, it profits me best to wait and see.
If he kills me, I pointed out, if I'm the next one to have my heart ripped out, you still won't know where he is. You won't be any closer to removing him and protecting your business.
True, Marconi said. Then he smiled, an expression that lasted only for a fraction of a second. But I think you will not be such easy prey. I think that even if he kills you, he will reveal himself in some way. And since our encounter the other day, I think I have a better feel for what sorts of things to look for. I scowled at him and turned to go, moving briskly toward the door.
Harry, he said.
I stopped and turned back around.
On a personal note, I know nothing that would profit you in any case. All of his people we have managed to take revealed nothing. They were that afraid of him. No one seems to know just where the drug comes from what it is made, or where this person does business. Shadows, they say. That he is always in shadows. That is all that I've learned.
I regarded Johnny Marconi for a moment and then nodded. Once.
Thank you.
He shrugged.
Good luck. I think it would be best if you and I did not encounter one another in the future. I cannot tolerate any more interference in my affairs.
I think that's a good idea, too, I said.
Excellent. It is good to have someone who understands.
And then he turned back towards his remaining two men, leaving the corpse of Gimpy Lawrence on the floor behind him. I turned and trudged out of the place, into the night and the cold and the misty rain. I still felt sick and could see Gimpy Lawrence's eyes as he died. I could still hear Linda Randall's husky laughter in my head. I still regretted lying to Murphy, and I still had no intentions of telling her any more than I already had. I didn't know who was trying to kill me. I still had no defense to present to the White Council. Let's face it, Harry, I told myself. You're screwed.
Have you ever felt despair? Absolute hopelessness? Have you ever stood in the darkness and known, deep in your heart, in your spirit, that it was never, ever going to get better? That something had been lost forever, and that it wasn't coming back? That's what it felt like, walking out of the varsity, walking out into the rain. When I'm in turmoil, when I can't think, when I'm exhausted and afraid and feeling very, very alone, I go for walks. It's just one of the things I do. I walk and I walk, and sooner or later something comes to me, something to make me feel less like jumping off a building. So I walked. It was pretty stupid in retrospect, walking around Chicago late on a Saturday night. I didn't look up very often. I walked and let things roll around in my head, my hands in the pockets of my duster, which flapped around my long legs while the light rain gradually plastered my hair to my head. I thought about my father. I usually do when I get that low. He was a good man. A generous man. A hopeless loser. A stage magician at a time when technology was producing more magic than magic, and he never had much to give his family. He was on the road most of the time, playing rundown houses, trying to scratch out a living for my mother. He wasn't there when I was born. He wasn't there when she died. He showed up more than a day after I'd been born, more than a day after she died. He'd given me the names of 3 magicians and then took me with him on the road, entertaining children and retirees, performing in school gymnasiums and grocery stores. He was always generous, kind. More kind and more generous than we could afford, really. And he was always a little bit sad. He would show me pictures of my mother and talked about her every night. It got to where I almost felt like I knew her myself. As I got older, the feeling increased. I saw my father, I think, as she must have, as a dear, sweet, gentle man. A little naive, but honest and kind. Someone who cared for others, and who didn't value material gain over all else. I could see why she would have loved him. I never got old enough to be his assistant, as he had promised me. He died in his sleep one night. An aneurysm, the doctor said. I found him cold, smiling. Maybe he'd been dreaming of my mother when he went. And as I looked at him, I suddenly felt, for the very first time in my life, utterly, entirely alone. That something was gone and would never return. That a little hole had been hollowed out inside of me that wasn't ever going to be filled again. And that was how I felt that rainy spring night in Chicago, walking along the streets, my breath pluming into steam, my right boot creaking with every step, dead people occupying all of my thoughts. I shouldn't have been surprised, I suppose, when after hours of walking, my steps carried me back to Linda Randall's apartment. The police were all gone now, the lights all off, all the gawking neighbors cozy in their beds again. It was quiet in the apartment complex. Dawn wasn't brushing the sky, but somewhere, on a window ledge or a rooftop nest, a bird was twittering. I was at the end of my strength and resources. I hadn't thought of anything, hadn't come up with any brilliant ideas. The killer was going to get a spell together to kill me the next time he had a storm to draw on, and from the way the air felt, that could be any time. If he didn't kill me, Morgan would certainly have the White Council set to execute me at dawn on Monday. The bastard was probably out lobbying votes already. If the matter came before the council, I wouldn't stand a chance. I leaned against the door to Linda's apartment. It was striped with police line, do not cross, yellow and black tape. I didn't really realize what I was doing until I'd already worked a spell that opened the door, unfastened the lowest strip of yellow tape, and walked into her apartment. This is stupid, Harry, I told myself. I guess I wasn't in the mood to listen. I walked around Linda's apartment, smelling her perfume and her blood. They hadn't come to clean up the blood yet. The apartment manager would probably have to handle that later. They never really show you the details like that at the movies. I eventually found myself lying on the floor, on the carpeting next to Linda Randall's large bed. I was curled on my side, my back to her bed, my face toward the sliding glass doors that led out to her little concrete patio. I didn't feel like moving, like going anywhere, like doing anything. Useless. It had all been useless. I was going to die in the next 2 days. The worst part was that I wasn't even sure that I cared. I was just too tired, exhausted from all the magic I'd had to use, from the walking, from the bruises and punches and lack of sleep. It was dark. Everything was dark. I think I must have fallen asleep. I needed it after everything that had happened. I don't remember anything else until the sun was too bright in my eyes. I blinked and lifted my hand against the light, keeping my eyes closed. Mornings had never been my best time, and the sun had risen above the tops of the buildings across the street. Cheerful springtime sunshine that dashed down through Linda Randall's curtains, through my eyelids and into my brain. I grumbled something and rolled over, face to the cool darkness under Linda's bed, back to the warm sunlight. But I didn't go back to sleep. Instead, I started getting disgusted with myself. What the hell are you doing, Harry? I demanded out loud. Laying down to die, I told myself, petulantly. Like hell, my wiser part said. Get off the floor and get to work. I don't wanna. I'm tired. Go away. You're not too tired to talk to yourself,
So you're not too tired to bail your ass out of the alligators either. Open your eyes, I told myself firmly. I hunched my shoulders, not wanting to obey, but against my better judgment, I did open my eyes. The sunlight had turned Linda Randall's apartment into an almost cheery place, overlaid with a patina of gold, empty still, to be sure, but warm, with a few good memories. I saw a high school yearbook lying nearby. Underneath the bed, several photographs serving as bookmarks. There was also a framed picture of a much younger Linda Randall, smiling brightly. None of the jaded weariness I'd seen in her in evidence, standing in her graduation robes between a kind-looking couple in their late 50s. Her parents, I presumed. She looked happy. And lying just in the edge of a stray little beam of sunlight, one that was already retreating as the sun rose over the edge of the buildings, was a small red plastic cylinder with a gray cap. My salvation. I snatched it out from under the bed. I was shaking. I shook the canister and it rattled. A roll of film was inside. I opened up the canister and dumped the film into my hand. The plastic leader had been retracted into the case. There were pictures on the film, but they hadn't been developed yet. I closed the film up again and reached into the pocket of my duster and drew out another canister, the one I'd found at Victor Sell's lake house. The two were a match. My mind spun around, taking off down a whole new track. An entirely new realm of possibility had opened up to me, and somewhere in it might be my opportunity, my chance to get out of this alive, to catch the killer, to salvage anything that had started going to hell. But it still wasn't clear. I couldn't be sure what was going on, but I had a possible link now, a link between the murder investigation and Monica Sell's aborted inquiry into the disappearance of her husband, Victor. I had another lead to follow, but there wasn't much time to follow it. I had to get up, to get on my feet and get going, fast. You can't keep a good wizard down. I stood up, grabbed my staff and rod, and started walking towards the door to leave. The last thing I needed was to get caught trespassing on a crime scene. It could get me arrested and stuck in holding, and I'd be dead before I could get bail. My mind was already rolling ahead, working on the next step, trying to find this photographer who had been at Victor's beach house, and getting these pictures developed, and seeing if there was anything in them that was worth Linda Randall's death. It was then I heard a sound, and stopped. It came again. A quiet scraping. Someone turned the key in the deadbolt of the apartment's front door, and it swung open. There was no time to flee beneath the bed or into the bathroom, and I didn't want to be limited in my mobility in any case. I leaped forward and stood behind the door as it opened, keeping very still. A man entered, slim, short, harried-looking. His hair, a listless shade of brown, was drawn back into a ponytail. He wore dark cotton pants, a dark jacket, and carried a pouch on a strap at his side. He shut the door most of the way and looked around with great agitation. But, like most people who are too nervous to be thinking clearly, he was seeing less than he should have been. And though his head swept over where I would have been in his peripheral vision, he didn't notice me. He was a good-looking man, or so it seemed, with strong lines to his jaw and cheekbones. He crossed the room and stopped short when he saw the blood-stained bed. I saw him clench his hands into fists. He made a strange, cawing little sound, then hurried forward to throw himself on the floor by the bed and started pawing underneath it. After a few seconds, his pawing grew more frantic, and I heard him curse out loud. I slid my fingers over the smooth surface of the film canister in my pocket. So, the mysterious photographer lurking outside of Victor Sell's lake house was here looking for the film. I had a feeling in my stomach, like I get when I finish a particularly difficult jigsaw puzzle, a particular satisfaction mingled with a touch of smugness. I settled my staff and rod silently into the corner by the door and flipped my official police consultant's badge, complete with my photograph on it, out of my duster, so it showed against the black canvas. I covered my ratty old T-shirt with a coat and hoped that the man would be too rattled and nervous to notice I was wearing sweatpants and cowboy boots beneath my duster. I kept my hands in my pockets, pushed the door shut with a little nudge of my boot, and just as it closed, said, "So, returning to the scene of the crime, I knew we'd catch you if I just waited." The man's reaction would have had me rolling in laughter on any other day. He jerked, slammed his head against the bottom of the bed, yelped, drew himself back from the bed, turned to me, and all but leapt back over the bed in surprise when he saw me. I revised my opinion of his looks.
His mouth was too pinched, his eyes too small and too close together, giving him the intent, predatory look of a ferret. I narrowed my eyes and stalked toward him, one slow pace at a time. Just couldn't stay away, could you? No, he said. Oh, God, you don't understand. I'm a photographer. See? See? He fumbled with the cases at his side and produced a camera from it. Taking pictures. For the papers. That's what I'm doing here. Just trying to get a good look around. Save it, I told him. We both know you aren't here to take pictures. You are looking for this. And I pulled the film canister out of my pocket, held it up, and showed it to him. His babbling stopped, and he stood stock still, staring at me. Then at the canister. He licked his lips and started trying to say something. Who are you? I asked. I kept my voice gruff, demanding. I tried to think of what Murphy would sound like if I was downtown with her right now, waiting for her to ask me questions. Wise, Donnie Wise, he swallowed, staring at me. Am I in some kind of trouble? I narrowed my eyes at him and sneered. We'll see about that. Do you have any identification? Sure, yeah. Let me see it. I speared him with a glance and added, slowly. He goggled at me and reached for his hip pocket with exaggerated slowness. With one hand, he drew out his wallet and flipped it open to his driver's license. I stalked toward him, snatched it, and studied it. His license and picture agreed with the name he had given. Well, Mr. Wise, I began, this is an ongoing investigation. So long as you give us your cooperation, I don't think that we... I looked up to see him peering at my name badge, and my voice trailed off. He jerked his wallet back and accused, You're not a cop? I tilted my head back in an arrogant angle. Okay, maybe not, but I work with the cops, and I've got your film. He cursed again and started stuffing his camera back into his bag, clearly meaning to leave. No, you got nothing. Nothing that connects any of this to me. I'm out of here. I watched him start past me towards the door. Don't be so hasty, Mr. Wise. I really think you have some things to discuss. Like a dropped film canister underneath the deck of the house in Lake Providence last Wednesday night. He flicked a quick glance up at me. I have nothing to say to you, he mumbled. Whoever the hell you are. He reached for the door and started to open it. I gestured curtly to my staff in the corner and hissed in my best dramatic voice, Finto servitas, jerked my hand at the doorway. My staff, driven by tightly controlled channels of air, moving in response to my evocation, leapt across the room and slammed the door shut in front of Donnie Wise's nose. He went stiff as a board. He turned to face me, his eyes wide. My God, you're one of them. Don't kill me, he said. Oh, God. You got the pictures. I don't know anything. Nothing. I'm no danger to you. He tried to keep his voice calm, but it was shaking. I saw him tilt his eyes at the glass sliding doors to the little patio, as though calculating his chances of making it there before I could stop him. Relax, Mr. Wise, I told him. I'm not here to hurt you. I'm after the man who killed Linda. Help me. Tell me what you know. I'll take care of the rest. He let out a harsh little laugh and eased a half-step toward the glass windows. And get myself killed? Like Linda? Like those other people? No way. No, Mr. Wise, tell me what you know. I'll put a stop to the killings. I'll bring Linda's murderer to justice. I tried to keep my voice soothing, even, fighting against the frustration I felt. Hell, I wanted to rattle him, but I hadn't meant to scare him so badly he wanted to jump through the plate glass sliding door. I want these people to stop just as badly as you do. Why? He demanded. I saw a little contempt in his eyes now. What is she to you? Were you sleeping with her, too? I shook my head. No. No, she's just one more dead person who shouldn't be. You're not a cop. Why risk your ass to do this? Why go up against these people? Haven't you seen what they can do? I shrugged. Who else is going to? He didn't answer me, so I held up the film canister. What are these pictures, Mr. Wise? What is on this film that is worth killing Linda Randall for? Donnie Wise rubbed his palms over his thighs. His ponytail twitched as he looked about the room. I'll give you the deal. Give me the film, and I'll tell you what I know. I shook my head. I might need what's on here. What's there isn't any good to you if you don't know what you're looking at, he pointed out. I don't know you from Adam. I don't want any trouble. All I want is to get my ass out of this alive and in one piece. I stared at him for a moment. If I traded him, I'd lose the film and whatever was on it.
If I didn't, and he was telling me the truth, the film wouldn't do me any good. The trail had led me here, to him. If I didn't dig up a lead to somewhere else, I was dead. So I snapped my fingers, letting my staff rattle on the floor. Then I tossed him the film, underhand. He dropped it, and stooped to recover it, studying me warily. After I get out of this, he said, we're quits. I've never seen you before. I nodded. Fine. Let's have it. Donnie swallowed and ran a hand back over his hair, giving his ponytail a nervous little tug at the end of the motion. I knew Linda from around. I'd taken some pictures of her for a portfolio. I do shoots for some of the girls around town. They want to make it into the magazines, most of them. Adult magazines, I asked. No, he snapped, nervous still. Uncle Abner's magazine for children. Of course, adult mags. Nothing really classy, but you can make good money even if you're not Hugh Hefner's type. So on Wednesday, Linda comes to me. She says she's got a deal for me. I shoot some pictures of her and give her the film. And I get... And she's real nice to me. All I have to do is show up where she says, shoot a roll through the windows and go. Deliver it to her on the next day. So I did. And now she's dead. Out in Lake Providence, I said. Yeah. What did you see there? I asked. And Donnie Wise shook his head, his eyes drawn past me to the bed again. Linda, some other people, no one I knew, they were having some kind of party, all candles and stuff. It was storming like hell, a lot of thunder and lightning, so I couldn't really hear them. I worried for a while about someone looking up and seeing me in the lightning, but I guess they were too busy. They were having sex, I said. No, he snapped. They were playing canasta. Yeah, sex. The real thing, not the fake stuff on a set. The real thing don't look as good. Linda, some other woman, three men. I shot my roll and got out. I grinned, but he didn't seem to have noticed the double entendre. You just don't get quality lowlife often enough anymore. Can you describe any of these other people? He shook his head. I wasn't looking, but they wasn't being too particular, if you take my meaning. Turn my stomach. Did you know what Linda wanted with the pictures? He looked at me and then snickered, as though I were extremely simple. Jesus, buddy. What do you think someone wants with pictures like that? She wanted to get leverage on somebody. Hell, it wouldn't hurt her reputation if any of the pictures of her in the middle of an orgy got out. But it might have some of the people with her. What kind of simp wannabe cop are you? I ignored the question. What are you going to do with the film, Donnie? He shrugged. Trash it, probably. I saw his eyes flick from side to side, and I knew he was lying to me. He'd keep the film, find out who was in the pictures, and if he thought he could get away with it, he'd try to weasel whatever profit he could out of it. He seemed the type. I trusted my instincts. Allow me, I said, and snapped my fingers. Fuego. The canister's gray lid flew off in a little rush of flame, and Donnie Wise yelped, drawing his hand back sharply. The red canister burst into flame on its way to the ground and landed in a crumpled, smoking lump. He stared at the film, then at me, his mouth gaping. I hope I don't find out you've lied to me, Donnie, I told him. He went white as a sheet, assured me he hadn't, then turned and fled out of the apartment, knocking loose two bits of police tape on the way out. He didn't quite close the door behind him. I let him go. I believed him. He didn't seem bright enough to make up a story on the fly, as rattled as he'd been. I felt a ferocious surge of triumph, of anger, and of a desire to find this person, whoever it was, who was taking the raw forces of life and creation and turning them to the ends of destruction, and put them in the trash with the rest of the garbage. Whoever he was, murdering people with magic and killing people by degrees with the three-eye drug, he was someone I wanted to put down. My brain lurched into gear. Now that there was something to work with, some other possibility for tomorrow morning than me dying in a variety of gruesome ways. Linda Randall had been planning on blackmailing someone. I took a staggering mental leap and figured it was Victor or someone out at his house during the party. But why? I didn't have any pictures now, only the information I'd gotten from Donnie Wise. I couldn't afford to wait around. I had to pursue the lead he'd given me if I was to get to the bottom of this and find out who had killed Linda. How had I managed to get into all of this trouble in only a few days? And how in the world had I managed to stumble across what appeared to be a complex and treacherous little plot by chance out at the lake house on Lake Providence on a separate investigation entirely? Simple answer. It hadn't been an accident. It had been by design. I had been directed there. Someone who wanted me out at the lake house and wanted to get me involved and to find out what was going on there. Someone who was nervous as hell about wizards, who refused to give out her name, and who carefully dropped phrases that would make me believe her ignorance, who had to rush out quickly from her appointment, and who was willing to let $500 go just to get me off the phone a few seconds faster. Someone had drawn me out and forced me into the open, where I attracted all sorts of hostile attention. That was the key. I gathered up my staff and rod and stalked out the door. It was time to talk to Monica Sells. I paid the cabbie who dropped me off a block away from Monica Sells' house in the suburbs. I was running out of time, out of Murphy's loan, and out of patience, so I didn't waste any daylight in walking down the street towards her place. It was a cute little house, two stories, a couple of young trees in the front yard, just now starting to rival the house for height. There was a minivan in the driveway and a basketball goal, well used. The lawn was grown rather long, but all the recent rains had left a good excuse for that. The street was a quiet one, and it took me a moment to realize that most of the houses on it were not occupied. For sale signs stood in many of the yards. Sparse curtains draped over empty, gaping windows like cobwebs. There wasn't a lot of birdsong for a street with so many trees. And I couldn't hear any dogs barking as I walked along the sidewalk. Overhead, clouds were thickening, building up for another thunderstorm. Taken all together, it had the feel of someplace blighted, a place where a black wizard had set up shop. I swung up through the cell's yard into the front door. I rang the bell and waited. There was no answer. I knocked. I leaned on the doorbell. Still no answer. I tightened my jaw and looked around. I didn't see anyone. So I turned back to the door, preparing to use a spell to open it. Instead, the door swung open, maybe 6 inches. Monica Sells stood inside, peering out at me with her green eyes. She was dressed in jeans, a plain flannel shirt with her sleeves rolled up, and her hair was covered by a bandana. She wore no makeup. She looked both older and more appealing that way. I think maybe because it was a more natural look for her, something that was closer to the sort of person she really was, rather than the nicer clothes and jewelry she'd worn when she visited my office. Her face went pale, her lips bloodless. "I don't have anything to say to you, Mr. Dresden," she said at once. "Go away." "I can't do that," I said. She started to swing the door shut, but I jammed the end of my staff into the doorway, keeping it from closing. "I'll call the police," she said, her voice strained. She leaned against the door, trying to keep me from coming in. "Do it," I growled. Then I played on an instinct, a hunch. "And I'll tell them about you and your husband." I was taking a shot in the dark, but what the hell? She didn't know I didn't know what the hell was going on. My instinct paid off. I heard her suck in a breath and felt her resistance on the door sag a little. I put my shoulder to the door, leaned on it hard, and she stepped back from me in surprise. I don't think she'd expected me to physically force my way into her house. Hell, I hadn't expected me to do that. I hadn't realized how angry I was until I saw the look of panic on her face when she looked up at me. I didn't know what I looked like, but it must not have been friendly. I stopped. I closed my eyes. I took a deep breath and tried to get a handle on my anger. It wouldn't profit me anything to lose control. That was when she went for the stunner. I heard her move, opened my eyes in time to see her snatch a black plastic case the size of a cellular phone from the piano and lunge toward me. Her face was pale, frightened. Blue lightning danced between the two tines of the stunner as she shoved it at my stomach. I swept my staff upright from right to left, and the buzzing device went past me, along with her lunge, striking the door frame behind me. I slipped past her into the living room, turning to face her as she recovered and turned around. "I won't let you hurt them," she snarled. "Not you, not anyone. I'll kill you before you touch them, wizard." And then she was coming at me again, fury replacing the terror in her eyes, and grim determination to succeed that made me think of Murphy for a second. For the first time, she was looking me in the face. For the first time, she forgot to keep her eyes averted from mine, and in that second, I saw inside her. Things seemed to slow down for a moment. I had time to see the color of her eyes, the structure of her face, to recognize where I'd seen them before,
why she had looked familiar to me. I had time to see, behind her eyes, the fear and the love that motivated every move she made, every step she took. I saw what had moved her to come to me, why she was afraid. I saw her grief, and I saw her pain. And the pieces all fell into place. Knowing the emotions that drove her, the terrible love that she was showing, even now, it all seemed perfectly obvious. I felt stupid for not figuring it out days ago. "Stop," I said, or tried to say, before she thrust the stunner at my chest. I dropped the staff and rod alike in a clatter of falling wood and caught her wrists in both of my hands. She pushed the stunner up my face, and I let her do it. It got within 3 inches of me, the light bright in my eyes. Then I drew in a breath and puffed it out into the stunner, along with an effort of will. There was a spark, a little puff of smoke, and it went dead in her hands, like every other electronic gizmo seemed to do whenever I came around. Hell, I was surprised it had taken so long to stop working. And even if it hadn't, it wasn't any trouble for me to hex it into uselessness. I continued holding her wrist, but the driving tension behind her arm had eased away to nothing. She was staring at my face, her eyes wide with shock from the meeting of our gazes. She started shaking and dropped the useless stunner from limp fingers. It clattered to the floor. I let go of her, and she just stared at me. I was shaking, too. A soul gaze is never something pleasant or simple. God, sometimes I hated that I had to live with that. I hadn't wanted to know that she'd been abused as a child, that she'd married a man who provided her with more of the same as an adult, that the only hope or light that she saw in her life was her 2 children. There hadn't been time to see all of her reasons, all of her logic. I still didn't know why she had drawn me into this entire business. But I knew that it was, ultimately, because she loved her 2 kids. And that was all I really needed. That and one other connection, the nagging resemblance to someone that I'd noticed in her at my office. The rest fell into place from there. It took Monica Sells a moment to recover herself. She did it with remarkable speed, as though she were a woman used to drawing on a mask again after having it knocked off. I'm sorry, Mr. Dresden. She lifted her chin and regarded me with a fragile, wounded pride. What do you want here? A couple of things, I told her. I stooped down to recover my staff, my rod. I want my lock of hair back. I want to know why you came to me last Thursday, why you dragged me into this mess. I want to know who killed Tommy Tom and Jennifer Stanton and Linda Randall. Monica's eyes went even duller. Her face paled. Linda's dead. Last night, I told her. And someone's planning on taking me out the same way the next chance they get. Outside, in the far distance, thunder rumbled. Another storm was in the works, slowly building. When it got to town, I was a dead man. It was as simple as that. I looked back to Monica Sells, and it was all over her face. She knew about the storm just as well as I did. She knew about it, and there was a sort of sad and weary frustration in her eyes. You have to go, Mr. Dresden, she said. You can't be here when... You've got to go before it's too late. I stepped toward her. You're the only chance I have, Monica. I asked you once before to trust me. You've got to do it again. You've got to know that I'm not here to hurt you or your... A door opened in the hallway behind Monica. A girl, on the gawky end of pre-adolescence, with hair the color of her mother's, leaned out into the hallway. Mom, she said in a quavering voice. Mom, are you okay? Do you want me to call police? A boy, perhaps a year or 2 younger than his sister, poked his head out, too. He was carrying a well-used basketball in his arms, turning it in nervous little gestures. I looked back to Monica. Her eyes were closed. There were tears coming, trailing down her cheeks. It took her a moment, but she drew in a breath and spoke to the girl in a clear, calm voice, without turning around. I'm fine, she told them. Jenny, Billy, get back into the room and lock the door. I mean it. But Mom, the boy began. Now, Monica said. Her voice was strained. Jenny put a hand on her brother's shoulder. Come on, Billy. She looked at me for just a moment. Her eyes were too old and too knowing for a child her age. Come on. The two vanished back into the room, closed the door, and locked it behind them. Monica waited until they were gone, and then broke down into more tears.
Please. Please, Mr. Dresden, you have to go. If you're here when the storm comes, if he knows...
She buried her face in her hands and made a quiet, croaking sound. I stepped over closer to her. I had to have her help. No matter how much pain she was in, no matter what kind of agony,